Parshas Vayeshev has a central theme of Lashon Hara. We know, of course, the Parsha begins, it says, Vayaveh Yosef, Estiba Samra El Abihem, that Yosef brings tales, brings negative reports about his brothers to his father. Chazal tell us different things he said. He accused them of Eber Menachai, of eating live animals. He accused them of moral turpitude, getting involved with women, and so on. And that led, of course, to a tremendous catastrophe. It led to the enmity between the brothers and eventually the sale of Yosef and then going down to Mitzrayim. And then later in the parsha, Yosef himself is the victim of, again, of Lashon Hara. It says when Eshes Potiphar is angry at Yosef for resisting her advances, so she, either in self-defense or for revenge against Yosef, accuses him to her husband Potiphar of having tried to rape her. And Yosef gets thrown in jail, again, a consequence of that was a completely false libel. It was exactly the chutzpah, the exact opposite was true. She had advanced on him, and he had resisted her. But again, these are two examples of the sin of Lashon Hara, of defamation, of libel, and some of the consequences that arise. Yaakov Kamenetsky has another angle of Lashon Hara in the parasha. He wants to know, he says, a student asked him, how can we understand how the Torah tells us such stories? The Torah tells us what the brothers of Yosef did. They seem to have done something monstrous. They sold their brother into slavery. How can the Torah tell us such things? Isn't that Lashon Hara? And the truth is, I don't know why this Talmud was asking on this story specifically. The Torah is full of stories about great men who did things wrong. David HaMelech, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Reuven later in Bereishis. Even in this week's parasha itself, besides Yosef, we have the story of Yehuda and Tamar, which sounds like a very sordid story. So the Torah doesn't shy away from telling us stories about the sins of great men. So I don't know why the question was asked specifically about the brothers of Yosef, but that's how Rabbi Kamenetsky reports the question. They asked him, how do we understand the Torah's willingness to tell us negative stories about the people in Tanakh? So he brings two terutzim. Rabbi Yaakov says, fundamentally, he says he doesn't accept the question. He says the brothers of Yosef weren't scoundrels who sold an innocent man into slavery. They had a dintari, he says. He brings proof to this. They had a logical reason to believe that Yosef had crossed the line, that Yosef was endangering their life, that Yosef was turning their father against them. And they ruled according to a dintara. They felt, according to their sober judgment, that he needed to be eliminated. And even if they were wrong, but it was an honest mistake, and it wasn't a coarse, vulgar sin as we conceive of it. Not sure how that really answers the question, because I think it's pretty clear from the Midrashim they were wrong. Whether it was as crude a sin as the Torah seems to indicate, whether it was more subtle, they clearly were wrong on some level. We say in the Asar Harugei Malchus, we talk about how Medrash indicates that was an onesh for the sin of Mechiras Yosef. The Haftarah, we say, Al-Mechram Bakesef Tzadik, the Evyon Bavor Nalayim, that the Torah clearly seems to indicate that they were wrong, on whatever level they were wrong. And again, there are many other examples in the Torah where the Torah does say that people did things that were wrong. So I don't know how this answer fully answers the question. I'm not going to focus too much on this particular angle. Rabbi Yaakov has another suggestion, which he proposes initially. He says something very interesting, which has major ramifications for Halacha L'maisa. Rabbi Yaakov says, initially when I heard this question, I answered, Lashon Hara, the prohibition of evil speech, only applies to the living. Upon the dead, it is permitted, Mikra Din, to say Lashon Hara. L'maisa says, there is something called the Cherem or the Kadmonim. There's an ancient Cherem, an ancient ban going back at least to the early medieval period, maybe earlier. There's an ancient ban against being Motzi Shemra on the dead. We'll discuss what that means in a minute. And that Cherem only refers to Motzi Shemra, which is false libel, not to Lashon Hara, which is true libel. Now, this Cherem is actually brought in Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchas Yom Kippur. In the laws of Erev Yom Kippur, the Shulchan Aruch brings a well-known halacha that a person should do tshuva before Yom Kippur, and specifically with regard to Averes B'Adam L'Chavero, interpersonal infractions, a person is supposed to ask mechila from his friends and from his not friends, I guess, from anyone who he may have offended or acted improperly, because the well-known halacha is that tshuva on Yom Kippur can't atone for an Averes B'Adam L'Chavero unless you appease the person that you offended. So one example of something that you can that you need to do tshuva for over there, you know, there are lots of things a person can do wrong, thousands and thousands of different things you can do wrong. One, for whatever reason, one concrete example the Shulchan Aruch gives is he brings this cheirim. There's a cheirim against being mostly shemra on the mesim. Anyone who had, obviously you can't ask the mace for forgiveness, but what you do in such a case, you take a minion, you go to the grave, and that's the best you can do, and you ask mechila from him in the Olam HaEmes, I suppose. But that, the Shulchan Aruch singles that out as an avera people have to be careful about, and that's this cheirim, which comes from the Mordechai, which comes from the ancient German Rishonim, that there is a cheirim against the Motzi Shemra on the mason. Now, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is telling us that the cheirim is only against false libel, against the dead, not true libel. We'll discuss, not everyone agrees to that, we'll discuss that more soon. I want to first explore a little bit the background of this cheirim. This cheirim appears in the Mordechai, and he says, many people ask, where did they get the idea to make such a cheirim? What basis does it have in halacha? So he says the source or the kind of the precedent is a medrash. He brings a medrash. It says, Parshas Vayeshanan, Moshe was pleading with God to go into Israel. So Moshe said, I don't understand. What did I do wrong? Why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu so angry at me? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you know why I'm so angry at you? So we know there are different midrashim, the Mei Meriva, there are different stories about what Moshe did wrong, different ideas of what Moshe may have done wrong in his career. One of the central themes is that he was very harsh toward Klal Yisrael. He spoke very negatively. He said certain times when he was upset at them for their failures or for their not living up to the standard he expected of them. So we know that Moshe occasionally speaks very harshly toward Klal Yisrael. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, he gives a whole laundry list of cases where Moshe spoke very, very harshly against Klal Yisrael. That he said they're going to say Lo Hashem Shlachani. Hashem, they're not going to. He accused them of being not having any faith in him. The story of Korach, Shimon Hamorim, the Mei Meriva. He said Kamtem Tachas of Asechem Tarbos and Hashem Chatoim. He said you've arisen in place of your fathers, a nation of a culture of sinful men. So why were you so harsh? Why did you speak so harshly to them? That's your sin. That's why you're not going into Eretz Yisrael. So Moshe said, I don't understand. M'chalamadati. Tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I learned this from you. You speak that way to the Jews. And he quotes a pasuk that Hashem says in the story of the Korach again. Hashem said, take, after they were all wiped out, Hashem killed them. It says, take the machtos ha-chatoim ha'ela. Take the pans where they offered the ketores. He called them chatoim. He called them sinners. So Moshe said, you also speak of Klal Yisrael like this. You also call them sinners and use negative language against them. So Hashem said, it's different. What you did is worse. Why? So ani amarti b'nafshosam v'lo b'avosam. I call them sinners. You said that you accused their ancestors of being sinners too, because you said, Kamtem tachas avosechem, you're following in your father's ways, tarbos nosh katarim, you accused their fathers of being sinful. And Hashem said, were Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov sinful? They weren't. You were so angry that you extended your criticism to their ancestors. That's crossing the line. So the Mordechai says, you see from here that saying unfairly, calumniating the dead, insulting them, and saying things about them that aren't true is an aver. The Mordechai continues, al chiruf shochnei afar, if you revile, if you contemn shochnei afar, a person is worthy of being punished because it's unacceptable to speak negatively, to libel the dead. So there is some debate in the contemporary poskim whether this applies to only false libel or even true libel. We know the Chafetz Chaim explained to us at great length, one of his great accomplishments was that he drilled into us over and over that Lashon Hara applies even on things that are true. Lashon Hara is not limited to lying. Even true things are still prohibited, unless it's a toelas. We'll discuss that a little more soon. Unless there's some point, some benefit, some necessary benefit, you can't say it even if it's true. So, in general, the real Isser of Lashon Hara applies even to true things. The example the Mordechai gives from this Medrash of Moshe speaking unfairly about the ancestors of the Jews, that they didn't deserve to be called Chotim, is an example of something that was false. It was Motzi Shemra. So the Achronim debates whether this Cherem, based on this Medrash, applies even to speaking true evil of the dead or only false evil. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is taking the narrow position that the Cherem is only on speaking ill if it's false. Since whatever the Torah says, of course, is true, there was no problem with the Torah speaking ill of the dead. So this is a major kula, a major halacha. According to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, there's nothing wrong with exposing the dirty laundry, discussing the sins and the failures and the embarrassing things of people who are no longer living, the way some Achronim explain it, they're in the Olam HaEmet, they don't get hurt anymore by, you know, we're human beings, we're flesh and blood, we get hurt, we get insulted, if people speak ill of us. In the Olam HaEmet, it's not such a problem. In the Olam HaEmet, people no longer worry so much about what happens if people insult them. Aruch HaShulchan, for example, says this thing, the Aruch HaShulchan quotes the Gemara that says people no longer are hurt and are no longer injured by people, what people say about them after they're dead. So he doesn't know about it, and even if he does know about it, he doesn't care. That's a good question. So Gabe is asking, what about the descendants of the people? We do find in Chazal in different places, when it comes to busha, when it comes to insults, Chazal did worry about what we call pigam mishpacha, that says, for example, that if you insult somebody, if you humiliate somebody who's sleeping and then he dies without ever waking up, even though he never felt any suffering or pain, it says it's pigam mishpacha, the family's insulted. There are other examples of this. It talks about nivul ames, about disinterring a corpse. The Gemara talks about, in certain cases, the Gemara talks about pigam mishpacha, that it's humiliating for the mishpacha. So it is true, you do find in Chazal that were concerned about the living family of the dead. So that's an interesting question. You certainly could hear an argument that there should be a prohibition of Lashon Hara even on the dead, even if they don't feel anything, because the family does. Yes, that's a good point. I don't have an immediate answer for that, but one way or another, it is a machlokus whether the mitzvah daraisa of Lashon Hara, the vera daraisa of Lashon Hara, applies to the dead. Okay, so Gabe is raising another point, which is that besides the prohibition of Lashon Hara, which is basically that you're making the person feel bad or suffer, there's another issue. Chazal don't approve of talking too freely about sin and shortcomings, because that can lessen the public moral. The public morals, it can lead people to think that sin is not so bad. Everyone does it. I can do it too. The Ashrei Nisui Chata, a person should in general not discuss his failings, because we want to maintain a public standard. So that's also an interesting point, I hear. Yep, then that could be a consideration too. Yeah, not sure what to say about that, but regarding the specifically regarding Lashon Hara, there are some Achronim, like Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who say that it's only a Cheirim, it's not an Issur Daraisa, and the Cheirim only applies to Motzi Shemra, not to telling the truth. This comes up, and we discussed a little while back the idea of writing history and writing biographies of people, and you want to discuss their life, the life story, warts and all, so to speak. So, you know, there's some debate among contemporary authorities. Are you allowed to write about the failings of someone who's dead? One of the concerns is what Gabe said, which is that it doesn't help us. Yeah, hearing that some people fail, or Schwab failed, it doesn't really help us. That knowing that they failed is not going to inspire us to be better. Other people fail, on the contrary, it does inspire us. Knowing that they were human beings like us, and that many people fail, that knowing they were humans too, and they had trials, and that they had struggles, and they overcame them, and still achieved great things, that is inspirational. And hearing that they were malachim, and they never had the same temptations we do, some people feel it's not useful. So that kind of argument, that whether it's good or bad for the as an inspiration for the public, can really cut both ways. But as to the Lashon Hara question, Rabbi Yaakov is telling us that it does not apply, as long as you're truthful, it does not apply to those who are dead. Now, there are those who disagree on both counts. There are those who argue, A, that the Cheirim does apply to Lashon Hara as well as Motzi Shemra, even telling the truth, if it's disgraceful, is prohibited. B, there are those who argue that the Cheirim was only to strengthen a pre-existing Isur. There are those who argue that the Isurim Daraisa, the biblical prohibitions, are in place too. And just because you made a Cheirim, that doesn't mean it was mutter before the Cheirim. Certain things need the strengthening of a Cheirim. But Rabbi Yaakov disagrees on both points. Rabbi Yaakov feels that A, without the Cheirim, nothing is Asur if the person's dead. And B, even the Cheirim is limited to Motzi Shemra. There are those who disagree on both points. So I don't know if there's any kind of consensus halacha lemaisa. But it is a controversial issue whether you're allowed to tell Lashon Hara about the dead. So Rabbi Yaakov gives two tirutzim to this original question. Why does the Torah tell us negative stories about biblical figures? One answer is because they aren't really negative, which is hard to understand. It certainly doesn't apply in many cases, many other cases. And B, the answer we're just discussing is that there's no real Issur Lashon Hara on the dead. There is a third answer, which I think is probably the most obvious answer. As a matter of fact, I'm really very puzzled by why Rabbi Kamenetsky doesn't mention this. The most obvious answer is, as we mentioned earlier, the most common, most talked about dispensation for Lashon Hara is Toelis. Chavetz Chaim says this repeatedly. All the poskim accept this. that one justification for Lashon Hara is Toelos, that if there's some benefit, if there's some need to telling over the story, then you're allowed to. And as a matter of fact, it's often even a mitzvah to do that. There is a delicious passage in the Sefer Pesachei Tshuva. There are a number of different Sfarim called Pesachei Tshuva. This one is a lesser-known work on Shulchan Aruch Har HaChaim, written by a 19th-century Rav in Vilna. He says the Bali Musar, he was writing before the Chavetz Chaim even, I think, but he says the Bali Musar were Marish Olamos. They go on at length, he says, about how terrible Lashon Hara is, how there's too much Lashon Hara, people have to be more careful. He says, I think a more serious problem is there's not enough Lashon Hara, he says, that people need to speak more Lashon Hara. He says, people are so strict and so reluctant to get involved and so nervous about saying anything, he says. The truth is, he says, Anochi Marish Olam Lehepach, I would agitate in the opposite direction. Oven Gadol Mizeh, a greater sin, he says, and Matiyos, a more common problem, is withholding information when it's necessary to save the victim from some sort of oppression. He says, obviously, if you saw somebody drowning, you saw somebody plotting to ambush and kill somebody, of course you would understand you have to step in, Lo Samar Al Dam Reecha, to save him. Okay, so those are very dramatic cases. He's ambushing him with a knife, he wants to murder him, or stuff like that. But he says it applies all the time. He says, in general, he says, anytime someone is going to do something which can harm somebody financially, he says, it's also the same problem. He says, if you see, what's the difference if he's tunneling under his house to break in and rob his piggy bank? Or if you see that his servants are pilfering stuff from the house, or you see that partners are embezzling money, financial crimes, white-collar crimes, more common situations, the same thing, he says. If you see that someone is being victimized by somebody else, you have a right and even a duty and obligation, he says, to save the victim by telling Lashon Hara. And this, I think, is well known. People generally do understand this, that you have a right and even an obligation to tell people to save the victims from being victimized. Now, obviously, the devil's always in the details, and what all the contemporary poskim struggle with is trying to pin down how far does this heter go? When should you step in and when should you not? In the case of shidduchim or other business cases, how black and white, how serious does the problem have to be before you jump in and do something about it? So there are a handful of interesting tshuvas about this in contemporary poskim. In general, most of the tshuvas are kind of the easy cases where you read the shaila and you're like, of course you have to say something, like, how could you not? So, for example, one of the tshuvas is in the Chelkas Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Breisch of Switzerland, second half of the 20th century. He was asked about a couple were engaged, were going to get married. The chassan had cancer, which he hadn't told his fiancée about. The doctors didn't give him more than a year or two to live. He was going to have to start undergoing chemotherapy or some other treatment. It would be bad for his fertility, I think. The marriage was going to be a disaster. The woman didn't know anything about it. So he says, yes, you have to tell her, he says. If you know, you have to tell her, he says, in confidentiality. What can you do? He says, yeah, she has the right to know. He says, no woman, it's pretty clear, most women would not want to get married to someone in this situation. And it's your duty to tell. He says, first of all, Osama al-Dam Re'echa, which is the reason all the posts can bring. L'samal al-Dam Re'echa literally means you see somebody drowning, you have to help him out of the river. But in general, the Chazal and the posts can extend that to mean if you see any Jew who's imminently, who's going to suffer a loss, even a financial loss, you have a duty to do what you can to save him, to forestall the loss, even if that means the post can understand that you'll cause some harm to another Jew in the process. If he's doing Shalom Kedin and harming another Jew, you have an obligation to stand up for the victim. So Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa is one reason why you must step in and save the victim from being victimized. Number two, he makes a very interesting argument. He says, Lifnei Iver. The Torah says, we discussed this a while back, Lifnei Iver L'Tzitein Michshol, do not put a stumbling block in the path of the blind. We know the Chazal understand this pasuk. They give it two meanings. One of them is, you shouldn't cause people to sin. You shouldn't help someone do a sin. He's morally blind. He's blind to the spiritual consequences and spiritual problem of what he's doing. But the other aspect of Lifnei Iver is bad advice. You're not allowed to give someone who's blind as to the ramifications of his various courses of action, you're not allowed to give him bad advice. Now, normally bad advice means actively, consciously, you're telling him, I think the Medrash's example is that you tell him, I think you should sell your donkey and invest the money in savings bonds. Really, a donkey is a very good investment at this point in time, but you want him to sell it because you want to buy the donkey. So you have an ulterior motive and you give him bad advice. So that's the normal case of Lefnei. You give actively bad advice, but Rav Reish argues at length that there's an extension of Lefnei Iver to passive Lefnei Iver. If you simply stand by and allow somebody to choose a course of action which is bad for him because he doesn't realize the ramifications of his actions, that's also Lefnei Iver. At least according to some poskim, he argues, passive Lefnei Iver is also too. You can't stand by seeing someone make a bad decision and not tell him. A very big chiddush, a very big chumrah. That also is a reason he says, well, you have an obligation to step in. If you see someone about to enter into a marriage and you know that he or she is missing information, and that information makes the marriage a very bad idea, something that they would clearly, certainly not want to get into. If they knew the whole picture, you have an obligation to step in and provide them that information. So again, these are kind of easy cases. He's dying of cancer in a year or two. Most cases that are going to come up in the real world are much more gray and much more black and white. He's not a complete drug addict, but occasionally he drinks a little too much on Shabbos. And you know, so the question is, where do you draw the line? How bad does the behavior have to be? We don't really have such good guidance from the postgame about these kind of gray areas. So that's why speeches on this topic usually say Rav should be consulted. I don't really have a better solution. Just a couple other examples postgame talk about. Another easy one, so to speak. There are tshuvos in the Tzitzis Eliezer, there are by Rav Avadia Yosef, tshuvos about if someone has a driver's license and he drives, and you know he's an epileptic, and he has seizures, which can happen when he's behind the wheel. And that's a major public danger. He is not, medically, he should not be driving. The Tzitzis Eliezer talks about that he should not be operating a motor vehicle because it is not safe for the public. So, Tzitzis Eliezer talks about the problem that you're his doctor and you are bound by medical confidentiality rules. Doesn't matter, he says, you have an obligation to disclose this. He says the public safety, preventing him from getting into a fatal car accident, for him, for others, trumps any duty of confidentiality. Even if you took an oath, he says, an oath to preserve confidentiality, it's clear. You never meant your oath to include cases where staying silent would place the public in mortal danger, he says. And therefore, you certainly have the right and even the obligation, again, to tell people, even though it's, again, Lashon Hara in the sense that you're disclosing embarrassing information about him, you're causing him to get in trouble, he's going to lose his license. It doesn't matter, he says. Your duty to the public to preserve public safety overrides any concern that you would normally have for the privacy and to protect the privacy and suppress negative information about somebody. There's a tshuva in the Debreciner, the Bar Moshe. Also, he says many times he gets questions like this on the telephone. People call him up and they ask him about shidduchim. He says a very serious problem. He talks about serious undisclosed problems, mental illness. He says chola tzavim, the illness of nerves, which he tells you in Yiddish is nervenkrankheit, sickness of the nerves, what we would call mental illness. So again, it's not clear what level of mental illness he's talking about. By some of the more expansive definitions, about a quarter of the public has some form of a moderate mental illness. I don't think he's talking about that. Probably he's talking about severe, and again, very often today the problem is many forms of mental illness are manageable with medication, with therapy. So these are very hard questions. If someone is trying to manage his condition, he is taking his medication, he is seeing the therapy, he is getting the therapy he needs. These are all very tough questions. And the Debreciner admits these are hard questions. So he says, in principle, he agrees with the Chalkas Yaakov. He says that certainly if there's information that the other side needs to know, then even if it's not literally life and death, but it can affect the character of the marriage, the quality of the marriage, you certainly should tell. But how do you know, he says, how do you know whether it's a problem with Samuel Damriyacha? He says, but how do you know what to do? He says, I get questions like this all the time on the telephone. How do I know what to tell them? He says, I don't know the facts. So he says a standard, which the Piskei Tshuva earlier, Rav Isserlin, in his discussion, they both adopt a very interesting standard. They both say what should be your guide and what to say and what not to say is whether your intention is purely L'Shem Shemayim or not. If your intentions are pure, you have no interest in this, you're not interested in gossip, you're not interested in the feeling of power, you have no vindictiveness against the party, if your interests are pure, you have nothing, you're no motivation other than preventing the other side from being victimized, then it's mutter. If you have any other mixed motivation, any other ulterior motivation, then you should step back. What should you do? The Debreziner says, if you have even a kurtiv of kin of a sin, if you have even a small amount of jealousy or hatred toward that person, then chas v'shalom, you shouldn't do anything, because you can't trust your judgment anymore. Your judgment is clouded. So what should you do? He says a very, very sensible, very logical thing. He says, you should call in a third party, call in somebody else who doesn't have your particular tendentiousness. Tell him the story. Let him make the decision of what to do. He says, Debreziner says, in his inimitable style, he says, many times I've gotten questions like these on the telephone where I didn't even know the other side. It was across the phone line. I gave him this advice. He says, I don't know what they did. He says, Mashasa Shoel, Mashasa Shoel, Matacheni Shla telephone. In any other day, I hope it worked out. He says, I have no idea. I have no follow up. So I don't really know where this went. Now, this standard of good intentions is a very interesting one. The Chafetz Chaim, in Hilchos Lashon Hara and Hilchos Rechilas, where he, again, clearly endorses the idea that Toeles is one of the key heterim, one of the few justifications for relating something that's problematic speech, is if there's a Toeles, if you're accomplishing something by telling it over. The Chafetz Chaim, though, says, at least in one of the cases, he says, you should only tell it over if you are mechavin l'toelas. One of the tznoim, he famously has seven conditions. One of his conditions is that you have to be l'toelas, and it also has to be kavan l'toelas. You have to mean it l'toelas. If you don't mean it for that reason, then that's a problem, he says. So a little while ago, I saw on Rabbi Natan Slifkin's blog, he says he had a debate with somebody about this. He says he was criticizing a certain public figure, he doesn't say who it was, very sharply. And he says, someone told him, you shouldn't be doing this, it's Lashon Hara. So he said, but it's L'Toelas. Yeah, it's important that people know that this person is problematic, so I think it's L'Toelas. So the other person said back, but you have a personal axe to grind with this figure, and therefore your motives are not pure. So Rabbi Slifkin says, so what? Even if that's true, even if my motives are not pure, objectively this information is true, objectively this information needs to be public, who cares if my motives are pure? So what about the Chafetz Chaim? The Chafetz Chaim says your motives have to be pure. So he basically doesn't understand the Chafetz Chaim, he grapples with it, he feels that it shouldn't be taken as a rigid halakhic requirement, and even if ideally your motive should be pure, so what? He argues, Misvara, that if objectively the information needs to be known, then why shouldn't you tell it? And the truth is, I discovered more recently, this point is actually a machlokas between the Sma and the Taz. The early Achronim on Shulchan Aruch, they actually argue about this point exactly. The case there that they're discussing is not Lashon Hara. They're discussing vigilantism. They're discussing if you see Reuven fighting with Shimon. You see Reuven, like Moshe said, Dasan Daviram, you see Reuven beating up Shimon. So again, L'samar al dam re'acha, you have a right and even a duty in certain cases to step in and save Shimon from being assaulted by Reuven. See somebody being mugged, if you can, without danger to yourself, you have to step in and, obviously in a real mugging, you have to worry about weapons and danger to your own life. But putting the question of danger to your own life aside, if you can step in and save the victim from the attacker, from the assailant, you have a moral obligation to do so. The Sma says an interesting condition. The Sma says that's only if you're the sort of person like Moshe Rabbeinu, who whenever he sees injustice, he doesn't give the example of Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm giving that example, steps in and intercedes. Mefarshim point out, Moshe Rabbeinu steps in and kills the Mitzri. He has to run for his life to Midian. The very, very first thing he does in Midian, he does exactly the same thing. He steps in, he fights off the powerful on behalf of the powerless. That was Moshe Rabbeinu's character, the Mefarshim say. He couldn't tolerate injustice. He had to step into the fray whenever he saw people who were taking advantage of the weak. He stepped in to save them, save the weak. So the Sma says, the only time you're allowed to, now again, when you step in to save the victim, you can do that if you have, you can do whatever you can. Ideally, you should just restrain the assailant non-violently, but if you have to, the only way to stop him is by punching him, is by knocking him down, you can do that too. So Sma says that's only if you're the kind of person who does that consistently. If whenever you see fights, you always step in to stop the aggressor and save the victim. But if you're a person who doesn't normally do that, and you're doing it in this particular case, perhaps because you have an ulterior motive, you don't like the guy who's the aggressor, so you're doing it because, again, you have vindictiveness, because you have some ulterior reason for wanting to attack the assailant, then you can't do it. Your motives have to be pure. If you're going to do something negative against a fellow Jew, you can only do it if your motives are absolutely pure. That's what the Sma says. Doesn't bring any raya, doesn't bring any real precedent for that. He just says it on his own. The Taz does not agree. Taz says, I don't understand. Any adad tamul zachilik. I don't understand why that's a necessary criteria. He says, objectively, it's the right thing to do. Dina hachni shiachal hatzolai de'aka samuka. Why do we care what your ulterior motive is? It's the right thing to do. So right reason, wrong reason, shalolishma, so what? Objectively, it's the right thing to do. The victim has the right to be saved from someone beating him up. So why shouldn't you do it? You're doing a mitzvah to save the victim. Why do we care what your kavan is? You didn't do it yesterday? So yesterday you did the wrong thing. Yesterday you should have done it. So go next time you do it. Next time, do the right thing and do it yesterday. Why should it affect whether you do it today or not? Today it's objectively the correct thing to do. What does it matter that on a different occasion you didn't do it? And I saw last night, preparing for this share, the Erech Shai, an important Achron from the late 19th century, he actually relates this back to Lashon Hara, or related Isurim. When we discussed Lashon Hara, so we mentioned earlier that Lashon Hara is even on the truth. There is, however, a very interesting discussion in the Poskim. When we discuss Lashon Hara, or Boshes, humiliating someone, there are always two questions. There's L'chatchila, whether you're allowed to do it, and there's B'di'eved, whether you're liable after the fact. There's actually an extensive literature in Halacha about holding people liable for insulting people. The question usually was insult. If you called somebody a nasty name in public, today we say, you know, it's just words, but back then, even today we have libel laws. If you publish something that you know or should know is not true, so there are legal consequences. And Halacha too, even though the Gemara says, M'vaisho b'dvarim is pater, if you humiliate someone using mere words, there's no civil liability. There was a later takana that the minhag is that Batei Din used to enforce this. If you called somebody a humiliating name in public, you called them a mamzer in the classic sense of born of an improper union. If you said somebody was a gana, if you said somebody was an adulterer, if you said something, again, not so much just you called him an ugly name, you made a statement which has objective factual content, and it was humiliating and it was not true, you would be held liable by Beis Din to compensate him for the humiliation. So the question arises, what if it is true? What if you called him something, you said something horrible about him and it happened to be true? So are you chayev or not? You're certainly not allowed to do it. It's certainly awesome. But the question is, b'di'eved, are you chayev? So the Ramah says, if you call somebody an eved, a slave, or a mamzer, if it's true, you're potter. So some Achronim say, the Chavos Yair, the Shvus Yaakov say, that's only in these specific examples of Eved and Mamzer, which are relevant for Yichus. You're not allowed to marry a Mamzer, you're not allowed to marry an Eved, so it was important that these people's status would be publicly known. We don't want it suppressed. We want people to know who's an Eved, who's not an Eved, who's a Mamzer, who's not a Mamzer. Therefore, we don't hold you liable if you say this in public. But something which has no halachic significance, like you say that, I remember you were kicked out of school 10 years ago for cheating, or I remember you once, when you were young, you were arrested for joyriding and joyriding with someone's car. It's humiliating, but it has no halachic significance. Then we have the Chavos Yair, the Shvus Yaakov, they say that then absolutely, not only is it aser, you're even chayer for doing it, and again, you're chayer for boshes, even though it's true. As we, to use the modern language, truth is not an absolute defense against libel. Just because something is true, if there's no public need for it to be known, then you are going to be chayev for humiliating him, even if it's true.
What about if the term that you use, the term itself, is in the eye of the beholder, so to speak, or in the ear of the beholder? Where someone can say, Bernard Sanders is a socialist. Depends on who you're saying it to.
So that's an interesting question. There is a tshuva, and I don't want to get into all the details of this tshuva. There is a tshuva about someone who was crooked, financially crooked. He took advantage of certain people to help out certain other people, and someone discloses publicly that so-and-so is kind of being like a Robin Hood. He was helping clients of a bank. He was giving them better terms. He was taking kickbacks. And he was helping the borrowers at the expense of the bank. So at one point in the tshuva, he says, is that embarrassing? I mean, he's a hero to the people he's helping. He's a hero. Who said that he's like a Robin Hood? Who cares that he's cheating the banks? Okay, so he discusses why that wasn't an issue, but that is an interesting question. If it's in the eye of the beholder, the question I think normally would be what the general public would feel. You're asking a kind of interesting borderline case where the public is split politically. To some people, it's a proud badge of being an ethical and considerate person. To some people, it's a kind of unfair, disrespect for private property. So that's a good question. Right? If it's something which genuinely there's a genuine split in public opinion on, that would be a very interesting question. I don't have a good answer for that. But so the Chavetz Chaim and the Shmos Yaakov both say that something which is a chait in someone's past, everyone agrees if he's done a proper tshuva and he's and done everything he could to do tshuva, you certainly shouldn't be saying it. That's an explicit Gemara. You should never tell about tshuva, remember what you used to do. You shouldn't tell a ger, remember what you used to do. But the question is someone who hasn't done proper tshuva. It's in his past, it was a long time ago, but he moved on, and he's not doing it today. But it is something, staying on his past. So the Chavetz Chaim and the Shmos Yaakov say that he's moved on, and that it's absolutely usur, even if you don't know that he's done real tshuva, if he's not doing it in an ongoing way, it's considered torshiyus boshes, and you chayev to pay for saying such a thing. The Erech Shai says no. The Erech Shai says the same way that knowing whether somebody's a mamzer or not, it's an important public need to know whether he's a mamzer or not. So knowing whether someone did an aver is also important. First of all, he's possible for edus and for shvuah until he's done proper tshuva. He's not trusted and based. And also he said people have to know to be careful. Someone's criminal record is relevant. They're having a big debate today about whether employers should be asking whether somebody was ever convicted of a felony. Many employers do, and the government is trying to change that. And there's a movement to try to change that so they can be rehabilitated and get jobs. But the Erech Shai is saying if someone did an aver in the past, someone did a criminal act or an act of theft or something in the past, public has the right to know. That just like they have the right to know if somebody's a mamzer, so they shouldn't marry him, they have the right to know that somebody did a financial crime in the past, because that's something of legitimate public interest, he says. And therefore, he says it's a mitzvah, it's actually a mitzvah for people to know this. And he says, and then he says, and even though your kavana might not be that way, he says, even though this person meant it just because he wanted to insult him because they got into a fight, he says, you did an aveira. He admits that it's wrong to do it for the wrong reason. But he says, objectively, it's a mitzvah. Like the Taz says, he says, just like the Taz says, that breaking up a fight is a mitzvah, even if you have some vindictive motive, that you shouldn't do that. It's wrong. It's an aveira to act vindictively. But at the end of the day, from the halakhic perspective, the act is objectively a correct act and needs to be done. So therefore, you're certainly not chaya for the assault if you did it for an objectively good reason, even if you had bad ulterior motive. So to Harry says, if you brought something which is of public interest to public knowledge, even if that wasn't your motive, you should have good motives. It is an avera on some level, he says. But nevertheless, we can't call that. We're not going to call that something that you're chaya for, because objectively, that was the right thing to do. This comes up also, this business about truth being a defense against libel, it comes up also in that tshuva I mentioned before of the Karnei Re'em, or Rafal and Kava of Morocco. He was that case about the bank where somebody revealed the corruption of the manager, disclosed it to the public. So one of the reasons he exempts the guy from having to pay after the fact, he says, is that it's true. What he said was absolutely true. He says he can't be tavea somebody in Beistin for saying something embarrassing, or even if he lost his job over there. He says he was fired for this. He says it doesn't matter. He says you can't be tavea somebody for humiliating you, for saying something that... Now, losing his job is a separate issue. We'll discuss that soon, maybe. But in terms of the fact that you humiliated him, one of the reasons, first of all, it's not a humiliation, as we discussed before, he says. And even if it is, he says, it's true. And truth is a defense against libel. You can't sue somebody for embarrassing you if what he said was nothing but the unvarnished truth. Now, we mentioned earlier, in the case of the bank manager, he actually lost his job. So the question is there a claim in Beistin if someone libels you? Let's even say it was false. Let's say it was not true. If someone libels you falsely and you lose your job because of it, do you have a claim in Beistin for that? So all the postmen agree that what you've done was something monstrously evil. You did a terrible avera, which you need major tshuva for and kapara. But the question is, do you have any, in Beistin, do you have any chashamishpa liability for causing somebody to lose his job? So the basic answer, the consensus of all the poskim is no. In spite of the fact what you do is a terrible thing, it doesn't rise to the level of a concrete enough hezek. Basically, it's a form of grum. It's indirect hezek, and Basin cannot find you liable for doing this. There are a number of different truths about this, starting from the Trumas of Deshen in the 15th century, going all the way down to the 20th century. Trumas of Deshen's case, there was a chazan, a shliach tzibur, who had, you know, that was the job. He was a professional chazan. And someone spread a terrible rumor about him that he was, I think, Zana. That he was a fornicator, that he was Shem Rash al Niuf, that he had been with women. And they fired him because of that. And by the time they were able to set the record straight that he was innocent, it was too late. They already replaced him with another chaz and he couldn't get his job back. So maybe he could sue them for reinstating him, but assuming he couldn't get his job back, the question was, is the person who spread the malicious rumor, is he liable for taking away his job? The answer is no, even though he did a terrible avera. He says, if Basin wants, they could penalize him, they could sanction him for doing such a terrible thing, but in terms of the normal law of mazik and nizik, he's not chayav because it's only a form of grum.
Is it because the person who was the libelous one, he was not the one who took the direct action of firing?
That might be that might be it, yes. So the laws of grama, the indirect causation of halacha, are very complex, especially in Chosh and Mishpat. One of the main reasons is, I think, the reason you said, that it's anytime you do something which causes something else to happen to somebody via a third party, that's usually going to be called grama. It's called indirect. Again, it doesn't seem fair, I understand that. There's no question he did a terrible avera. But in terms of charging, suing somebody in Basin, there are very, you know, rigid rules for how direct and how, you know, first-person activity has to be. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why, one of the main reasons why he feels it wouldn't be actionable in Basin. There's a case in the Ohalei Tam, of Tam ibn Yahya. He talks about a case of, you know, a little less salacious case, a little more down-to-earth. He talks about a case where there was a partner in a business, and people spread rumors about him that he was untrustworthy, that he was financially corrupt, and it says that he was fired because of his alleged crimes, but he was completely innocent again. So again, he rules, like the Trumas of Deshen, that Mikra Din is not Chayev. It's indirect. It's the harm he caused, a terrible harm, terrible affair, it's incorrect. And he says if Basin wants, they can penalize him and sanction him as a warning, as a lesson to society that this is not acceptable. But in terms of strict technical Chosh and Mishpat laws, he wouldn't be chayav because, again, it's only a grama. One of the reasons is, like you were saying, Eli, he says it can only be chayav for indirect, it can only be chayav for this type of thing. If you yourself do it, and here it wasn't you, they fired him, even though you triggered it, you can't be chayav for that. Rav Shlomo Kluger, in the 19th century in Russia, He has a version of the case, which again goes back to the lurid and the sensational. In his case, there was a sofer, somebody who wrote Sefer Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzos, and somebody spread a horrific rumor that he had raped a girl, and it was false. And he obviously lost a lot of business because of this. So he says, again, Medina, it's grama, and he can't be mechayev him. And he says it's hard to quantify. He says, who knows how much business he would have gotten going forward. This kind of business is inherently unpredictable. I guess, you know, you can show your sales for the last 5 years and show that on the average you made between $60,000 and $80,000 a year. You know, even if it's not, you can't predict it exactly. But he says, halacha would consider the fact that you can't quantify exactly what the loss is. Rocky says, again, like all the posts can say, Menashe Shemayim, his onesh will be terrible. He says that it's a terrible avera, certainly, and Rav Chaim Pelagi has a case, back to the Svardim again, Rav Chaim Pelagi has a case in the 19th century where, again, there was a businessman, and he was a delicate position of trust. People trusted him with their capital, and someone spread a rumor that he was drunk, that he was an alcoholic, and therefore, I guess, not someone you should trust. So, again, he lost his business. Again, he says, Mikra Din, it's a terrible thing, but Mikra Din, you can't be Mechayev. I'll just close with one case from Yitzhak Zilberstein, contemporary. He talks about a case of, again, there was a sofer, again, someone whose livelihood was based on people trusting him as being a Yerush Shemayim, and someone spread, again, a terrible rumor about him, and he lost his livelihood. So he says, what's the guy supposed to do now for tshuva? He says, take out an ad where you publicly admit that it wasn't true. He says very astutely, that'll backfire. He says, anyone who didn't know until now will find out about it now. Nobody will trust the apology. They call this a Streisand effect. They're trying to suppress information, sometimes causes it to become more talked about. There's no etz, he says. So he's not discussing so much strict kosher mishpah, whether you're chayav or patur. He says, if you want to do tshuva, the only thing you can do is to make up for the rest of the guy's life, the livelihood you took away. You have to make it up to him. You have to give him a monthly stipend. Very strict, he says, but otherwise you have the aver on your conscience. He says, he brings a kind of precedent for this. The precedent is debatable, but he brings a precedent. The halacha is, if a man rapes a woman, the parasha of Onus in the Torah, it says he has to marry her. Some of Farshim explain, he damaged her marriage prospects. He has to marry her to make it up to her. If she wants, she doesn't have to say yes. She may say, I don't want to see you ever again. If she wants, then he has to marry her. So in the Haggos Mach, it says, what if he can't marry her? What if he's already married? What if there are other reasons why he can't marry her? In the time of the Rishonim already, the polygamy was prohibited for Ashkenazim. So he says, what if he can't marry her? What do you do then? So he says he has to give her money in the form of a major dowry to help her get married. Her marriage prospects were hurt by this. He has to help her get married. So Rav Zilberstein says, you see from this that if you injure somebody's prospects going forward, even grama, not grama, he doesn't approach it from the perspective of strict Chosh Mishpah, but he says, you see this idea that you have a moral responsibility to make it up to them and to make them whole, so to speak, to the extent possible. You can't erase the trauma, but to the extent possible, to the extent where there's some concrete thing you can do to put the person back where they were before you did your terrible thing, you have a moral obligation to do that. Now, you can argue that that was a specific halacha in Onus, where the Torah wrote, Veloti Elisha, but he understands as a more general paradigm, anytime you do something to someone which hurts their prospects in life, you have a moral obligation to do what you can. Whatever money can heal everything, but what money can do, you have some kind of moral obligation to do what money can do and pay the money as a form of tshuva.